and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, September 20th, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Lola Dean. Today's session number is DEL 2001-04, and it's entitled Elder Hostel. It's a book discussion about Stones from the River by Ursula Heggie, and this is part four. Let's listen in.
Today's 100 pages is a little easier in some ways and brings some answers in others. Tomorrow's 100 pages is going to tie up just about every loose end that I think we have. And I'd like to have you kind of think about, as you're finishing the book in your reading for tomorrow, what are some of the main themes that you have seen throughout the book that you have found that have impressed you? And then also, I'd like to have everybody pick out your favorite character. That's always kind of fun to see. Well, who appeals to which person? And I'm sure you'll all have one that, for some reason or another, you either identify with or you found to be funny, or there was something about them that you liked. So if you do those two things, and then we'll see if we have some commonality on the themes that we saw that throughout the book. There's a couple that come back in very strongly tomorrow, and so I think that at least one of them will become very clear to us. Okay, any thoughts left over from yesterday? Or any places that maybe you didn't have a chance to read until last night from yesterday that you'd like to comment on?
I like the way she called Max Box 241 for about 10 pages because she didn't know his name.
Yeah. And when
she
wrote it. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, Max. I guess it's in tomorrow's reading. But I'll just say it now. One of the things that always has distressed me, even though I was quite young when the Second World War happened and ended, I think in later years and later reading, one of the things that always saddened me most about that war in terms of physical loss outside of people was the loss of Dresden. And it had been such a beautiful, beautiful city, and then to have it all just wiped out, especially when there was no military object there, it seemed such a shame. Such a shame. But war is about loss, so that was just one of them. Well, let's go back to 42. Trudy's 27 years old, and a whole new dimension is going to enter their lives. Well, let's see, I haven't quite got to a page yet. I think it was on 320 is where kind of where we started. And we have Erna Neiman and her son Conrad. And this is the beginning of Leo and Trudy's involvement with saving the Jewish prisoners, with the Jewish people who were trying to flee. And as in, there were many places, and I would be interested to see if Minna and Otto from Copenhagen, were any of you living overseas during?
Not during World War II.
During World War II. As I told you, my neighbor was, she got caught there, and she still can't talk about it. But to see if they remember any of the sort of undergrounds that existed, because I had a friend who was involved in the Danish underground resistance group, and they smuggled people all the time. And this is what Leo and Trudy get involved in. And who do they get involved with in this process?
Two.
Taylors, right, that live right next door. And what do they do?
They built the tunnel.
The tunnel. And one of the things that they found in the tunnel was the stones. The stones come back again. And they are used as part of the foundation for the tunnel. Now, the people that they, that also at this time, there were a lot of other people that came to Bergdorf, and these were prisoners who came, and they were Greek, French, and Eastern European. sent as essentially indentured help to help the people in various businesses during that time. So Bergdorf must have looked quite a bit different now with these other folks scattered throughout the community. And Herr Hesping, what was your thought about him? Did your thoughts change about him in this chapter? How?
He seemed like someone who just enjoyed people and sometimes possibly used them. And now he seems to be not that way at all.
Is that him?
Yeah. He used to keep have these secrets that had been, you know, harmful to people, and now he was keeping secrets to help.
He was very careful in what he told Trudy and Leo, wasn't he? That each group had to have a certain amount of information. It was kind of the need to know, which is kind of a more current term. Yeah, go ahead, John.
Well, I was going to say the big thing is he was the benefactor, the unknown benefactor.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it came out yet.
That's okay.
I thought it was in this part.
It is in this part. Oh, okay. Yeah. And why do we?
I was being very careful about this.
I'm going to let you go right to the unknown benefactor because it's on page 411.
Okay.
And because he does show up early in the chapter, and it's just impossible not to go to the end of the chapter and to deal with the unknown benefactor. And what if, let's see, on the begin, right after the break there. Ruth, why don't you go ahead and read that? The identity.
The identity of the unknown benefactor was discovered one night in May. Instead of following his pattern of leaving gifts, he attempted to take something away. What he stole was a Hitler monument in front of the Rathaus, the greenish statue with the flawed ear and crusted oxygen droppings. The unknown benefactor was apprehended in the process of loading the shark statue into a wheelbarrow, his open toolbox next to him. From what the people of Bergdorf would hear afterwards, he was shot right there while trying to joke about taking the fur on a stroll because it had to get boring standing in one place for so many years. Not that the police figured out immediately that the thief was the unknown benefactor. That came when they searched his apartment and found a worn ledger, a kind a bookkeeper might have used decades ago, with detailed entries dating back over 30 years, listing people's shoes and clothing sizes, ages of children, illnesses, hobbies, needs, and secret wishes. Columns with check marks and dates documented all the gifts he mysteriously smuggled into houses, bicycles and baskets of food and books and toys and money and coats, including roller skates for a boy by the name of Andreas Veil, who had since grown up to become one of the policemen who shot the unknown benefactor.
Thank you. Can you imagine how that town must have buzzed when all of this came out? But how sad that it was.
How guilty they felt.
Yeah, right.
That whole statue thing was so funny in that here the pharmacist is running around collecting money, and when they finally bring it, this copper statue in, and Helmut says, all right, you know, what did you do with the money? Because there's this little statue about the size of a little kid with one bad ear.
I think we found out later that some of the money was
embezzled.
And then we find out on page, and we find out all through this particular part that we're reading, Herr Hesping's brother is very instrumental as well. He was a bishop, a Catholic bishop, and he was involved with the transfer of the Jewish people. And so he was really sticking his neck out the entire time. And about two-thirds of the way down, the bishop comes after the funeral to have a drink
some schnapps, I think it is, with Leo. And let's see, who would like to read that? Irma, would you like to read that? It's down on page 413, about halfway down, after Leo shook his head.
I know the bishops refilled their glasses. I've seen too many others pulled out of high positions. The only one I know of who's spoken up without harm to himself is the bishop from Munster. It's a mystery to me. You've done a lot of good working in the background. In furious silence, the change in policy, you know, say, killing the Jews instead of trying to push them out of the country. Gimel used to argue that it did not arise from the war situation, but was intended all along. And you, the bishop, asked, what do you believe? I'm not sure. I've never been as sure about things as your brother. But in my darkest moment, I agree with him.
Thank you. And then he goes on to say, you will also be hearing rumors about Herr Hesping, because the money came from embezzling it from the gymnastic centers that he was running.
That's okay.
Yeah. But the bishop here also points out that the church was divided, as we've been hearing every morning at 8:30, that there were different parts of the church and their concern and beliefs about what was happening as far as this whole movement of the Jews. So here was one who did stand on his principles and his ethics, as Von Kuffer did. Yes, Barbara?
It must be the bishop, the Catholic bishop that Dan mentioned, right, is the one Catholic hero.
Well, it could be, or maybe there were others.
He said he was from Munster.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Oh, yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So that would be the same one.
It's good you asked.
She's done a good job. A good job on her research. I think this book is fairly accurate in many ways. Okay, so back to the time that we have the people coming in to live in the house. Now, this made a real change for Leo and Trudy, because they have the front of the house is the pay library, and then there's their own quarters where many times before people had been coming in, but now they have Erna and Conrad there, so it makes a little bit problem situation. You can't just have people in with some refugees sitting in the front room. So it makes it kind of a big problem.
She had to lie to Matthias and tell him that the piano was broken.
And that comes out later, that was something that was kind of sad.
Yeah.
So they have a lot of other kind of practical kinds of things. How do you feed four people when you're only allowed food for two? And how do you, I wasn't quite sure about the dishes. I mean, I couldn't figure out why they couldn't just put four dishes down and wash them and put them back on the. But that seemed to be.
She was afraid somebody would come into the house.
Yeah.
While they were eating.
Yeah. If there were more than two dishes on the table, I would.
Yeah.
Because that happened in 88 to me when, in the East German Republic, when a group of Christians were allowed to go into homes, they only sent as many people as were in their family and sent the other people in their family away.
For that same reason?
Yeah. And that was in 88.
The Corey Tendrum's hiding place, too. They did that.
The Corey Tendrum.
Rushed the dishes away when heard the ring of the bell.
Are most of you familiar with Corey Ten Boom? Yeah. The book hasn't been heard of much in the last few years. But she's another one who survived the German occupation. And she was a German Christian, as I remember.
Dutch
Christian. Okay. And did they hide?
Judy Hybo,
it's a long time since I've read that book.
Then she was in prison. I'll always remember that they were praising the lice because it kept other people away from them.
That's always something.
Everybody needs to speak up.
I didn't hear what you said.
She was so thankful for the lice because it kept other people away. They could have their little Bible studies.
So we had
lice.
You know, louses. Kind of difficult things to get rid of. And then after we had Erna and Conrad, we had kind of a surprising addition to the group.
Eva.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Eva had a problem being separated from her husband, didn't she? Conrad had a problem. Yes, Betsy. Go ahead.
I just hate for that little boy. He just felt like I can't return back. He'd be reunited with him.
Now, if it were a dog, I could understand it better. But he loved his cat. I'm a dog owner. And this little cat that he had, and, you know, we don't know what happened to the cat, but I'm sure his mother, the description of the mother was interesting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
She was practical.
Because he was more attached to Trudy than he was to his own mother.
Yeah. She was a survivor. But she had a bit of a hard edge, you kind of felt.
Yeah.
She had told Conrad that she gave the cat to a nice, deserving family in the train station. Uh-huh. And she really might dump it in the waste basket or whatever.
Probably.
Remember that postcard that they sent later? It said they found the, maybe that was just code. I don't know.
I think that way she knew exactly who it was from, because that's all he had on it, wasn't a train station and a cat. Yeah. So she knew that they were safe. In Switzerland, wasn't it? Isn't that where they went? Okay.
Sometimes the people have hurt so much and they've taken all they can take, they become hard. Mm-hmm. Many of the nurses came back just like a little tough, tough, tough ladies because they couldn't take any more hurt.
Kicking off the star and everything, so anything that would attract attention to them, like a cat, no one would be
a cat
much more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. On page...
she was almost caught, wasn't she?
Yes, she had been almost caught, yeah. So she was very wary. As I say, I think she was really a survivor. And it takes something to be that. On page 360, we have a little more description of the tunnel itself, as to how that was going. See, Roger, would you like to read that when you find it?
350?
I'm sorry, 360. Yeah. It starts with "in some way."
Mm-hmm. In some way, each fugitive contributed to improving the tunnel. Eva stretched thin fabric from her nightgown beneath the ceiling to catch flecks of dirt that might sift into her eyes or settle between your neck and collar. She was the only one who had been staying with Trudy and Leo since spring. The others came and departed quickly, bearing dreadful stories, far more dreadful than anything Trudy could have invented, as if some deity had gone mad while contriving demented plots. And each plot telescoped within itself the plots of others that the fugitives had encountered on their desperate journeys. As Trudy listened to them, she was overcome by the sense of the unbelievable, as if it were all were transpiring in a world far more outlandish than Pia's Island. Whatever had happened in her family and her town before Hitler and his brown gang had seized power, including the death of her mother and the disappearance of George Wyler's father and the wedding of Klaus Walter, even a rape in the Brown Myers barn. She could have imagined herself spun forward into the texture of a much greater motif. But these new stories carried to her by the people she harbored, she could have never invented. They stomped her, bludgeoned her with their finality, although their findings were obscure.
Thank you. And there were times when the police did come and almost found this, but somehow or another, the tunnel was never discovered. Did you get any sense of how many people there actually were? Anyone? She doesn't talk about all of them.
Coming and going. The priest named Adolf.
Right.
They never did hear about it yet.
Well, she only kept them for a short time, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. After the first group.
After, except Eva.
Eva stayed.
Doesn't really say it.
Yeah.
What was the name of the person that took them away?
Hesping.
Emil Hesping.
Well, I thought that's the fellow that did.
He was the unknown benefactor. Yeah. And got shot. What about Eva? Poor Eva.
She suffered the fate of those who love much.
She took a chance.
Very well.
Juliet, Eva, some of the others.
And then her husband didn't stand up for her. That made me angry.
Yes.
He was so much paralyzed.
Well, she had said that she wouldn't mind going back if he would go with her if she was ever apprehended. And I think she really believed he was going to. And what did the German soldiers say about him? Here's your hero.
But I didn't quite get that. Was it because he didn't stand up for her and they pronounced him a coward?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't Jewish.
And he lives with that.
Yes.
Quite a while. For
the next reason for Salonia when he answered the door.
Yeah. 150 pages.
Yeah.
Oh, right. You know, when they were keeping the mother and the little boy Conrad, and Trudy had, all she had left was this little bit of lotion in that bottle from Frau Simon, and she'd been sharing it with her because she noticed her hands were sore when they had to leave and they felt so bad, and she gave her the lotion.
That was a very generous act on her part. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The Rosen family, Dr. Rosen, they did get out. Remember, they left. Mm-hmm. And we do know that they survived. They went to Switzerland and they made it to Switzerland. How few did, though? We head back to the Abramowitz family, though, again, on page 339. We're sort of jumping around today, but we kind of have some themes here. And the Abramowitzes are still together at this point. At the bottom of the page, let's see, Julian and Betsy, do you have a book there? Mm-hmm. Would one of you like to read, starting at the very bottom of page 339, the paragraph that starts, "It's amazing."
It's amazing, Michelle thought, what people can get used to and still call life. We have lost most of our belongings. We have been crowded into small rooms. We're not allowed to leave our hometown. We can't use public transportation unless we work more than 7 kilometers from home. We're no longer permitted to possess cameras or binoculars or opera glasses or electrical appliances. We've had to turn over our radios and jewelry. We're not allowed outside our rooms between 8 at night and 6 in the morning. We've been kicked, beaten, and humiliated. We've had our families ripped from us, and yet we go on living.
Read the next paragraph, too, please.
He thought of all the times he'd raged against his wife for accepting each new attack with dignity. Diane Unpossum's fähigkeit, your ability to adapt, is far more dangerous to you than any of them will ever be. But how much better was he? He'd come to accept all that, too, only out of fear.
Thank you. So we have adaptation and hope that nothing will happen, and adaptation because of fear. And that seems to be one of the key words of this book, is how far do you go in adapting? So.
The following things talked about, the new law said the Jewish men up to 75 and Jewish women up to 70 had to do forced labor.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to bring that out too, because I thought that was being at those ages in our life, it sounds terrible.
But the next step was they were gone.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just this progressive denigrating them by taking everything away and then making them work and then disappearing them.
It's like building the pyramids in Egypt.
Somebody had to do it.
Well, Ruth got the divorce, finally, the daughter, but then she goes to live in Dresden.
Yes.
And wrong city to go to at that time.
So she was never heard of again. Now, we had the pharmacist family, and I thought that they were sort of interesting because the pharmacist, remember, he was one of the Heil Hitler men.
Mm-hmm. He was the one that took the statue at 2 o'clock in the afternoon for a walk.
Yes. Uh-huh.
He was also the one who collected the money for the Hitler statue.
Right. But his wife and daughter were part of the network that hid Jews.
But he hadn't talked to the daughter, was it 30 years? Because
something she married, like
married
a Protestant.
And
right.
And his wife divorced him. Right.
And all of them ended up going to the work camp.
Can't you just hear him trying to explain that to the Nazis when they go, but I haven't talked to her for 30 years.
Yeah,
it's not funny, but...
The priest came back in, and we'll see the priest again. The priest is one of those figures that has kind of, you know, we're kind of on this circular thing that just kind of keeps bubbling up to the top every now and then. And yesterday, Dan was talking about... In many churches, they had the priest, and then they had the party priest. And remember when in this Catholic church, at the beginning, when the old priest was still there, and they brought in this new priest, who was the one who was more attuned with the party, and brought in the Nazi flag and things like this. Well, now, he's the only priest. And there was one point that he said... He wished that he had access to the old priest because he needed to figure out how to get to talk to someone. Do you remember that at all? It stuck with me because all of a sudden here was this first kind of self-doubt that he really didn't know at all. But now he's the fat priest. And he's kind of a character. Anybody want to talk about him? I found him kind of interesting.
He was a moocher.
Yeah.
One of his great aspirations in life was a car, and all he got was the motorbike.
Yes.
No cigar.
I wonder why the people kept giving him food if he was already too fat.
He's trying to get in good with the Lord.
Penance?
Yeah.
But would that have something to do also with church records? I wonder if they thought that if they treated him well, then maybe he would hide some of the church records or something, so that when the Gestapo came in,
yeah,
you know...
That was one of the ones that we knew about that Dan didn't know about this morning, about the Lutherans or the Catholics that had been... Remember the Catholics that all of a sudden disappeared from the Catholic Church because some grandparent had been... The research that they had done, which amazed us yesterday when we were talking about that. That they'd been so thorough. So that would have been in the church records.
But it was very common in Europe for people to tithe by feeding the priest.
If they didn't have money.
And in fact, when we were Presbyterians living in England, we had an Irish Presbyterian pastor come to our church. And he moved in with a whole room full of crocked eggs because he had been... a minister in an area that grew chickens and eggs, and people tithed with their eggs. Mm-hmm. And they moved them all to England with them. And she said to me, can you tell me any more egg recipes? They would eat five meals a day, and three of them at least had eggs in them, and she baked all the time. But the eggs were in crocks that were preserved in them.
Oh, so they were, because they stayed.
Yeah.
What did they put in the eggs?
Water glass.
That's what it's called. Water. I forget what the chemical combination is.
Well, out of the food bank, they had all these 5-gallon jugs full of hard-boiled eggs.
Well, these weren't hard-boiled. These had the shells on them.
Fresh.
And the, whatever, the what you call it?
Water glass.
Water glass. That seals the the
yeah,
eggs,
my mother used to save her eggs.
It doesn't get in there, yeah. But and you know, it's very common for some churches, the priest has a place to go every night for his
dinner.
Yes.
Well, and he comments on that people weren't invited to dinner quite as much. But how would you like to have been that housekeeper? I mean, here she thought she had dinner all ready for the next day, and she'd go and open the covered, and the priest had been out during the night eating all the food. I think he was a mess. Well, we go back again to another theme that we keep hearing, and this is about Trudy's stories. And on page 361, we have some thoughts about Trudy's stories. Okay, who hasn't read yet? Marianne, you haven't read yet, have you?
Not today.
Already forgotten.
But my Indian name should be Air Hogger.
Oh. We won't worry about that. I don't think everybody's
Air Hogger wanted me.
We like to entertain us.
Where do you wish for me to start?
Already her gossip. About halfway down.
Already her gossip had taken on a new pattern. She would select her stories, conscious of preserving the safety of the people who relied on her, even though she'd feel restrained because there was so much she couldn't tell. Like about the woman crippled with arthritis whose husband had looked after her with such tenderness, unaware how amazed Trudy was by the kind of love that didn't flinch from physical differences. Or the young nurse from Berlin who'd stolen two spoons from the Montags before she'd been taken to a new place. Or the young priest who despised his name Adolf and had given her a new respect for the clergy, not only because he'd hidden Jews in his church in Dresden, but also through his stories of other priests and ministers, some of them fearful souls, he admitted, who had spoken out against the oppression of the Jews and had been arrested or even killed.
Thank you. So here we have Trudy having to adjust her storytelling to a whole new dimension because of concern for the people that were living in the house. So she had to, what was it called in the war when you had to leave out words?
Censor.
Censoring, thank you. She had to censor her gossip. The next section that impressed me was started on at the very bottom of 362, and it has to do with sort of information overload, is what I wrote down. Annie, do you want to read that, starting with that last line on the bottom page and about two-thirds of the way down on 363?
Okay. After I escaped, he shook his head and started again. And what he told Trudy took away forever any doubt she might have still held on to. Doubts that those rumors of people dying by the hundreds in camps were far too horrible to be true. She saw the priest crouched in the woods outside high loops of barbed wire, saw him stumble away from a vast grave, naked bodies shoved into the gouged earth, twisted in indecent embraces. He made his way through the woods to Weimar, where his favorite poets, Goethe and Schuller, had lived and written, and he hid between the tall monuments in the cemetery near the crypt where the two poets rested in splendid recognition. Those nights in the cemetery, the priest scraped the foam down his left cheek. I thought I'd go insane. I could not understand how some people's graves could be marked while others were obliterated without evidence. It felt more horrible than any other injustice I've ever known of. I couldn't fathom it. I tried to, and the trying was crazy-making. Gradually, he'd moved west, aided by people he said he'd never forget. During his flight, he met other fugitives, but only one woman who'd actually escaped from inside a KZ. Dachau, smuggled out by a guard. The woman who had shared a hiding place behind the false wall of a closet with the priest for 8 days had told him about the camp, the filth, the hunger, the open sores. But what had been the worst for her had been the washroom, where together with others she'd had to strip, stand under the ice water and get doused with disinfectants that made her eyes sting while guards laughed or pushed them around.
Read the next paragraph.
Okay. All at once, Trudy wanted to stop the information coming to her, wanted to block the remembering of what the priest had already told her, but knew that his words were carved into her soul as surely as any moment she had lived. What happened to the woman, she asked hoarsely, her forehead covered with sweat.
Thank you. The thing that impressed me here was this barrage of information, and I think that all of us have suffered that in the last 2 weeks. And when do you get to the point where you just don't want to hear anymore? You just get to the kind of a numb state. And then,
that way the week before I came.
Yeah,
yes.
That's when that. Mm-hmm. And then you have to have some time to be able to sift through it to find out, you know, what is the part that is important or what is the part you can believe. But for them, how this must have been absolutely horrendous.
But yet, if you talk to many of the Germans today, they all claim they didn't know what was happening. That's what I find so interesting about mm-hmm. this book.
You know, I had three cousins who brought home war brides, one from Scotland, one from England, one from Germany. And the one from Germany, my cousin died, and she went back to Germany for a short time and met this man who was a chef. His name was Billy Kranz, and they came back to Pittsburgh and resettled in America again. But he, during most of the war, he had been in a prison camp in Russia. So when he tells his stories, right. he still doesn't believe any of this happened.
Really?
And he's, you know...
And of course, that's one of the things that people are concerned about. I don't know. You know, it's interesting in a community, and I'm sure all of you live in some kind of a community where you know what's happening to some extent. We live in a community where almost everybody knows almost everything that's happening, because there's only 164 people. But still... In a community that size, there are times when things come out that you wouldn't have believed. Secrets that have been kept. Incest probably being the most significant one. I don't know, you know, how people didn't know what was happening. Of course, they didn't have the communication systems that we have today. Even if the news was filtered, or they didn't have television, of course. The radio they got was the German radio, although they did have the radio in the closet. Remember, Leo had the radio in the closet, and they could get the BBC. And then Trudy would dispense that information on her rounds on her bicycle. Remember, she was kind of the town crier. But I don't know about how do you know what is true and what isn't. And the German love of order probably kept a lot of that not wanting it to be true.
We have a good friend who was a young married woman at the time in Germany. Mm-hmm. She still lives in Germany. And her family lived in a city. I don't know exactly how large.
20,000.
She was with her mother. Her husband was in the service, and she was with her mother. She had children. Yeah, one. And her father was an official in the chemical company and had been required to join the party in order to keep his job. He was, it sounds like he was kind of a neutral. He wasn't, although she will tell us to this day all the good things that Hitler did for the Germans. And after the war, he was... imprisoned by the Americans because he had been a party member. And he, along with other people of significance, the town officials and people who were significant, were taken to a nearby camp. I don't know what was near there.
I don't either. I didn't know there were any near there.
Yeah. And they were forced to see the bodies in the grave. They were forced to see what had happened because they didn't believe it. They honestly did not believe it. They did not. And she still doesn't want to believe it.
Yeah.
She will argue about it. That she's
I don't
not
think
sure
she will anymore.
How many of you remember the day Life magazine arrived with the pictures of the camps?
I didn't see that, but I saw the newspapers every day as it came out.
I'll never forget that as long as I live. And that's the first we really knew about it.
When would that have been?
That would have been right as they went into Dachau. Life photographers were there. Dachau, what was the other big one? Buchenwald.
Buchenwald.
And Auschwitz. And the pictures that, well, of course, then it came on film, too. But I remember that magazine arriving. And it was picture after picture after picture.
I probably was not allowed to look at it.
Was that about
3 or 4
It must have been 40. Well, it was right at the end of the war, so that would have been 45.
Okay, I was in college. The same German war bride used to say to my dad, I don't know why the Americans, they were from Straubing, I don't know why the Americans bombed Straubing. We only made one little part for the Messerschmitt. But, you know, and really, how would they know?
Yeah. Going back there in the 60s and visiting this little town near Stuttgart, and although the people that we were visiting had a very modern home with all the conveniences, the village itself was really pretty primitive still, you know. And every morning the kids would go down to the bakery and pick up fresh rolls, and every evening at 5 o'clock they'd carry their milk pail down, and the dairy would give them their milk, and then they brought it back, and the woman in the house had to pasteurize it herself. It wasn't in this modern house, you know, she still had to pasteurize the milk. And I don't remember a radio or TV. I don't remember a newspaper. Maybe the communications just weren't that great. And this would have been in the 60s. Of course, when they were in England with us, they led a pretty different life.
Yeah.
Things were still... And yet it was so safe. I know all of our children could get on their bicycles and ride all over town, and we never had to worry about this. And my kids had so much fun that when we started to leave, we couldn't find them. They were hiding under a bed.
The earth nest.
This was the greatest place on earth to live, and they were going to stay there.
When was the Voice of America important? I have a vague memory of that, but I don't remember.
When would it... John, can you help us?
When did it start?
But was it involved in this at all?
Well, I know they had radio operating out of England.
Rosie.
BBC was probably...
Rosie the Riveter, or what was her name? No, that was Tokyo Rose.
Yeah. Oh, Tokyo Rose. That's not the other side.
That's the other side, yeah.
The Germans but had a couple of people.
There was a question.
The Voice of America.
Didn't Voice of America start after the war?
Yeah.
As part of the Lend-Lease and
the fight? It was during the Cold War
that
the Voice of America came on.
We had, you know, how little things come to you. We spent a vacation in, where were we? We went to Jamaica. And we got Radio Moscow. And it was talking all about being in a sleigh and how much fun this was, going behind the horses with Sibelius's marvelous, you know, what is it, Corelia Symphony. And I can remember hearing that, what is this? You know, why are we getting communism being bad? This was not that many years ago. It was really a fascinating kind of coming from Cuba, of course. And
Moscow,
Cuba was still...
Moscow had a woman that ran a program at night. Mm-hmm. It was popular music, and her name was Moscow Molly. And she would beam her programs into the United States and throughout probably Europe also.
Yeah.
And she knew an awful lot of things about us. When I was in the military in the Fairbanks, and we were working on top of a hill, Birch Hill, she said happy birthday to one of the boys up on Birch Hill.
That's scary.
Well, she said, and we know you're there, and we know why you're there.
Well, you have to tell them about Birch Hill.
Well, we were kind of the forerunners of the modern eye in the sky, and where you're looking down and with the cameras and taking pictures. We had some instrumentation that we flew out of there. So we were trying to locate where their ICBM firing stations were. And eventually it was pretty clear that they were on the Kamchatka Peninsula, at least the ones we were. And so obviously they also had people in Fairbanks that knew who we were.
They knew your birthday.
She said, happy birthday, Earl. And he was from Tennessee. She played happy birthday for him over the radio. So that was kind of interesting. We used to monitor that every night.
And that was before computers. So
yes.
Right.
Yes. So can you imagine what's going on now?
Wow. They say that's the best form of spying is to have a mole in there.
And yeah.
That's why during the war on the 11th, they thought there was a mole in the White House because they knew exactly where Bush was. And they knew that that target coming that went down in Pennsylvania was supposed to get the president. And they didn't know whether they were to go to Camp David, the White House, or Florida. And that was why, I don't know whether it's come out yet.
Apparently there's some more information.
Yeah, but they said there was a mole in the White House because they knew exactly where Bush was and that he was their target.
Yes, Bill.
I'm not sure where he is.
As you found out, mountain trip. Then we went to Italy, and we advanced up to the line of combat in the middle of the night, in the sleet in the winter. And as soon as we arrived, the Germans announced over a public address system across the no man's land, welcome to the Mountain Division. And they listed all of our officers. And then they said, if you don't make any big moves, we won't either. We'll just sit here.
That was, what, 1944?
Wow.
Yeah.
Good idea. Good answer.
By that time, I think some of the German zeal for the army had sort of slowed down. That's when the army was sort of starting to disintegrate a little. Well, we better get back to our book or we won't finish the
thing. The services over in the Pacific did not know what was going on over in Europe.
You're right. They were so busy.
They knew it's going into them and all taking place.
Right. I think the Pacific was sort of divorced from
us. And they thought they would be moving there first before they do over here. A lot of people were disappointed because the United States did not actually come first to be taken care of. We took care of the other side of the world first.
Yeah. But finally it all ended up within a very short period of time, which was good. Well, let's go back to Trudy's house. And on page 370, we have kind of some nice things about Matthias. There were some good things every now and then that kind of bubbled up in this book. Let's see, Mary Ellen, you haven't read it. I thought you'd like to be there.
I thought you'd like to be there, Matthias said as he handed Trudy two cream-colored envelopes, one addressed to her and the other to her father. What is it? An invitation? He'd come to the Pay Library, but had waited between the stack of books until Frau Bilder had checked out 5 war novels and maneuvered her bulk out of the door. Trudy opened the envelope and read the announcement for his piano recital. Oh, Matthias, she said, I'm so pleased for you. Of course we'll be there. Thank you. He flushed with pride. I even have a tuxedo. You'll look all grown up then. The unknown benefactor left it out in our kitchen. How about that? When? Just this morning. And it fits?
Okay. Then if you skip over to the pair, just fits the next, skip the first line, a couple lines on the next page, and then it's been added again. At the top.
He's been at it again?
Uh-huh.
The unknown benefactor, I heard that Frau Emmers, you know, she gets that awful rash on her scalp, found 2 bottles of the medical shampoo she hasn't been able to buy, right in her chicken coop. Listen, can you stay and visit? My father's in the living room.
Okay, thank you. So here's our unknown benefactor back again. This also brings us up on Matthias has been studying with the Jewish pianist, who had been allowed to stay. She was allowed to stay in her house, and she had her room. Her maid housekeeper had been sent away, and she was called to entertain the rest of the house had been taken over as sort of a resort. for the rest of the for the German officers, and then she was required to play for them whenever they required that. Must have been a real change.
You know, the part that really got me, that when she was practicing, trying to do anything, they stood there and looked at her, you know.
Right. Or when she was playing, they'd walk around talking. That was not very pleasant.
But she couldn't even practice in peace.
It says, Fräulein Bernstein, though Jewish, had been protected so far because of her fame. And then it tells about her mansion became a villa. Down at the bottom of that page is a little thing that helps us understand Trudy just a little bit more. At the, well, it's the very, very bottom of the last paragraph.
What page is that?
On page 372. It says where she's talking about music being so important to Matthias and that it is his sort of his life. And she says, music even then had been a way out of pain for him. She wished she had something like that, something that could sweep her away from the grieving that sat with her all too often. She grieved over Conrad, the priest Adolf, and now Eva, and each one tilted her right back to her oldest grief, the loss of her mother. I thought it was such an interesting way that she put that. It tilted her back. That's a nice turn of phrase. And then this next part, we have the premonition coming back again. Trudy felt herself drawn into Matthias's music, but when she closed her eyes, the music became that of Fräulein Bernstein and spun her through the images of that second grade spring concert. The sound of boots on marble tiles, high white bellies of pregnant girls, babies crying. Trudy sat up straight, her eyes wide. The boots, they were here now on these marble floors. And so was that fear she felt as a girl. The bellies, she thought as the music pumped through her. What about the bellies? She didn't want to know. Yet she felt this future sucking at her, trying to prove itself to her through these boots, vowing that the bellies and the babies too were waiting in that vortex of time. She's good about giving us these kind of forward-looking things, that things are going to happen. And then what happens at the concert?
She makes a foolish remark.
Trudy is picked up and arrested.
Right. Trudy goes to jail. So she spends a little time in jail, but she manages to keep it. As she's going out, her father comes running out with her coat. Lise let her take this coat. And so there she is, sitting in jail with everybody else. But she does get up, but she has a little problem there. Can't figure out how to pee. So there, and this, of course, was the convent. So there's the closet. And
St. Rita of the Wet Feet.
Yes. Remember, there's a statue in the closet. She says, doesn't she say, excuse me? St. Rita of the Wet Feet is a good way to put it, Mary. Okay, on page 376, we have another little indication of what's happening here. Halfway down. Let's see, Edith, could you read that? It starts last summer when a group...
Last summer, when a group of Jews had been rounded up outside the taxidermist shop, Gerda, who had been sitting on the front stoop, had been taken away in the truck along with them, despite her father's cry, "My daughter isn't Jewish. From what he'd been able to find out, she'd been brought to a research clinic, supposedly to be studied with the other retarded people.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there was much studying that went on. So that's another indication. This, again, is 19... 42. Then we have, I wrote down this one. There's 376, Gerda. I've written down, see if somebody can help me on this, the guard. And Frau Simon, who keeps telling stories, which made me think of 1001 Nights. Does that ring a bell with anyone?
Yes, it's when she's called in finally after 3 weeks.
And she's telling the story to the officer. Do you have that, Barbara?
No. Here it is on 382.
Now remember, this is the same SS officer, if that's what he was. Anyway, he was a German officer. And, you know, we don't know if he really had orders to release her or if he was the one who made the decision. But what does she do? She starts telling a story. She starts using her power, her information power. And why did I write down Gerda Heidenreich?
Gerda was the daughter of the heavily retarded.
Right. Okay, yeah, that had to do with that. Okay. So on her part, who would like to tell about this interview she has with the... Oh, she really got fanciful, didn't she?
I think she did. The one last sentence there, she tried to feel out what would pull him into her story.
She often says what people wanted to hear, but this is the first time it totally determined the story. So what does she tell him? About this man who has his heart on the outside of his chest?
You can see it beat each time.
And he says, what does any of this have to do with being his word? And then she tells him, she reveals a little of herself, doesn't she? She tells him about how she tried to get tall and when she'd hang from the bar and try to stretch and try to make her head smaller. And he says, go on. It's kind of like the 1001 Nights. Was it Scheherazade that told the 1001 Night tale?
Yeah.
As long as she kept telling a tale, keeping his interest, she was going to live for another day. So then she goes on, and he finally says to her, watch that mouth of yours, salute the flag, sing when you must, and don't complain about any of it. And he loves her both.
Because he was the little boy that was laid out. She said,
she had a premonition about him also.
Yeah.
That he would be dead in the spring of 43.
Right. I think one of the saddest things in this particular time that we read about is when Judge Speaker is taken. And because he made a remark after a long case about if things kept going as they were going, Germany might not win this war. And just it seemed like a man who shouldn't have been imprisoned. That was, to me, a very sad part. And he comes up in tomorrow's reading as well. And then we have kind of a nice part. We have her affair with Max on page 394.
That's nice.
Yeah. Ursula Hagee has a way of giving us information that is really hard and really pulls us down. But then she kind of is able to bring something up again, and then you're okay for another 20 pages. And then you're okay for another 20 pages. So you kind of get this back and forth kind of rhythm that she writes. At the bottom of page 394, let's see, Jean, you haven't read yet, have you? Mm-hmm. Start with people don't always.
People don't always tell each other everything right away. Their face felt hot. What do you mean? Wouldn't you agree that it's better to wait to reveal some things until you know the other person is ready to hear them? I'm not sure. Well, you wanted to know if I had faults. And you do. You said I was too perfect. I would have settled for something less dramatic than life.
Thank you. I think almost anybody would. At that point. That was a little bit much. Okay, at the bottom of this page, we also have another tragic chapter starting. And that is that Ingrid Baum returns.
Can you believe?
Yeah.
She's pregnant when she comes?
Yes, she's pregnant. Ingrid is pregnant. And, of course, how does Ingrid view her pregnancy? And in tomorrow's reading, it's really going to become a factor. A tragic factor. So that just kind of keep that in mind. On page 409, we have another stone story I've written down. Hopefully. Okay. And this I think John referred to earlier. It's after the break right there, that spring. Let's see. Have you read yet, Beth?
No. I talked too quietly.
Read loud.
That spring, Max's car was confiscated for the war effort, but the watchmaker from whom Max rented his room let him borrow his rowboat and bicycle. As the evenings grew warmer, Max would bring his bicycle in the boat across the Rhine and ride it to the Baumeyer's jetty, where Trudy would meet him. Each time they made love on the jetty, Trudy felt herself reclaiming the place a little more. That cairn, Max had asked when he'd first seen the pile of rocks at the end of the jetty. Does it mean anything? She saw herself at 13. I don't know what it was.
Go ahead.
Hurling stones into the river and coming back here more than 5 years later after seeing Claus Malter and Bridget Rothschuss. One stone for loving him, one for hating him, one for her longing, one for her rage, one for her shame at loving him without him loving her back. She felt a story stirring within her, and she spun it for Max, for herself. The cairn is hundreds of years old. She began her tale about a water fairy, a tale of betrayal and love and shame, even though she didn't know the details yet. Each stone means one life, and those long-ago people who survived the revenge of the water fairy swore to always remember her with this cairn. Those stones are restored after each flood, though no one knows who keeps up the ritual. Some say she's still there in these waters, keeping vigil over the cairn, waiting to add other stones for everyone. What happened to her? Why was she so vengeful? She wasn't always that way, Trudy spoke slowly, giving words to the images as they rose within. People used to watch her swim in the river, admiring her uniqueness, her grace. You see, from the waist up, she was shaped like a woman. But instead of legs, she had the tail of a fish. It was silver and green and flashed when the sun touched it. Men fell in love with her beauty and wanted to possess her. And one morning, four of them, all at once, she couldn't go.
There's our stones coming back again. Mm-hmm.
It's no wonder she could look at those police that came to find the people that they were hiding, and she could just tell them anything, you know. Mm-hmm. She's had a lot of practice, hasn't she?
I was amazed that in 1943, Max's car was still running. Remember? When he first came to Cambridge, gave her a ride that first time, you couldn't open and close the doors without him using his screwdriver or whatever.
And that was kind of the problem. Of course, they couldn't get parts, probably. Mm-hmm. Lorraine, would you go ahead and let's read to the next break, because I think the rest of this is good, too. Max took her hands.
They lured her to the shore, right here, with promises of being her friends. And then they carted her off into a church and tried to split her into being like a woman. But she escaped. Now the words were rushing from her, She escaped from them and dragged herself back to the river, bleeding. It took her many months to heal. And after she was strong again, she brought the river into their houses and took her revenge. She drowned one of the men in his bed, another in his cellar. She killed every one of them, Trudy whispered. Every single one. And always afterwards, she would bring a stone from the bottom of the river. She pointed to the car. To remember the dead, Max said. The living, too. There are more than four stones. Because when she was done, she came after their families, too. After each person who had loved them. The story was frightening to Trudy. She remembered hiding from George in the tower of the church, scaring him and herself with ghost stories, and then scattering their fear with stories of comets and water fairies. Water fairies. But now even her story about the water fairy was grim, and she couldn't think of a new story that would undo her fear. She went too far, Trudy said, and with each stone, she added, she felt heavier inside, colder. She glanced out over the river and thought how she'd undermined the boys who'd hurt her. Now the war had become her instrument of revenge, at least for two of them. Hans-Jürgen Braumeister was reported missing in Russia, and Fritz Hansen had returned 6 months ago without a jaw. It had been shot off. Already he'd had two surgeries and would need seven more. She'd heard from his mother before his jaw would be restored as much as possible. He wore gauze from his neck up, and saliva ran down the front of it, making it look soiled, even if it had just been changed. What if the water fairy were to toss those stones in the river, Max asked. Why? To release centuries of hate. But once the stones are gone, she might forget. He looked at her steadily. Right, he said. She might forget.
And that would have been the question, one of the questions, I guess. You know, every book, when you finish, you're left with some questions. Would have been, you know, what if Max, this is tomorrow's reading, but what if Max had survived and had come back? You know, how would Trudy have been different? Because that is one of the things that you kind of wonder. The last thing that I had just written down was that Helmut returns, that he returns for a military funeral. And his widow, Hildy, that part was quite the last two pages before 419 and 420. If you don't have a chance to read those, you might just read them. And it's just kind of interesting about this must have happened over and over and over again with them burying their dead. The widow's response was quite interesting as well. And so that's just one of those kind of poignant parts of the war. Okay, for tomorrow, all you have to do is finish the book. But there's only 100 pages. And I think it's kind of, I think that John's smart. I have to do this in a book that has lots of people in it. I have to make a list, because otherwise I forget who's who. But tomorrow we should be able to kind of pull together all these strings, and our tapestry should be fairly complete. So I think some of the things we've kind of gotten already, the stones, we now know.
You know, there's one place in this reading, this 120 pages, where she said that she was raped in the barn.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. Now, that was not really specific at the beginning.
No.
And then she had said assaulted, but here she says raped.
But this is not her motivation.
It could have been, and we'll never know.
Because at one point she was angry because they hadn't
followed
her that way. They were only interested in knowing who it was.
Maybe the author forgot.
She said,
if we had Ursula Hagee here, we could ask her. It'd be fun to have Ursula Hagee here so we could talk with her.
Before I forget, it told me, I guess it's Mel Blanc, but I was trying to write something. Which opera is it, you know, where they are these Bohemian is living, you know, in Paris or wherever, and Mimi is dying.
La Bohème.
La Bohème, yeah. Yeah, I just said, oh.
Okay, so tomorrow for tomorrow, you're going to bring your favorite person in the book, and also we'll see if we can type some common things. This book was an Oprah.
Oh, good.
And unfortunately, I didn't see it. I wish I had. I'd love to have taped it. Because, of course, when they do a book like this, the author is usually there. And it would have been interesting to see her interviewed. I've never seen her interviewed, but I certainly would like to talk to her. And it's also interesting that it's a German writing this book. Okay, let's see, 4 o'clock, you have your choice between folk dancing, paper marbling, or what were they talking about?
What were your directions?
Spiritual directions, so have at it.
And the school.
Oh, anybody want the school?